We will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. We have a quorum. And we also have some minutes from March 2nd, so we will... Who's up for doing minutes? I mean, Representative Fritz moves the minutes of March 2nd. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the minutes of March 2nd, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails on the minutes for March 2nd and approved. First bill up today is House File 1164. Zalki, Representative Zalki, and the State Patrol are upon us. Please proceed with your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members, and sorry, but no treats. I think I've done enough of these where somewhere in here I don't have to be called the treat bringer, but so I apologize if you want treats.
Is there an amendment?
I recommend that we move House File 1164, that it pass and be referred to the General Register. Before we go any farther, I do have an amendment that I would like to move. It's a bill in the shape that I'd like.
Okay. That's Amendment 805-0162.
Yes. This amendment came to me from the DOT, Department of Transportation. They were a little bit concerned with the amount of slowdown requested in the bill, and they would like to change that from 20 miles an hour to slow to a minimum of 10 miles per hour.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the Zalki amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment 805-0162 is adopted, and we now have the whole bill in front of us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got Captain Brian Erickson and Sergeant Kurt Mowers from the Highway Patrol. Kurt is from the Brainerd Lakes area, and I asked him to come down as well, so I'm real pleased to have him with. But I'm going to really let them talk about this bill. We had legislation very close to this in the past. It was not considered clear enough, and so that's what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Captain Brian Erickson with the State Patrol. If you you will recall, back in August of 2000, Corporal Ted Foss, a trooper down in our Rochester district, was killed while working on the side of the road. He had stopped a vehicle, a small van, had a family inside, husband, wife, two children, and he was proceeding to take care of some business at the roadside in his work zone, essentially. A truck, tractor, trailer coming from the east failed to slow down, failed to move over, collided with Corporal Foss's vehicle, struck the van, and Corporal Foss was killed at that scene. As a result of that, we came back a few years ago and asked for your help in trying to clarify what a driver needs to do when there's an emergency vehicle on the side of the road. Subsequently, that change has been referred to as the Ted Foss move-over law. And what that law required was that a vehicle, upon approaching an emergency vehicle with its lights displayed on the side of the road, would move over, if possible, to another lane. The way that law was written got a court challenge. That court challenge said that the language was not quite clear enough and did not provide for a full lane of separation between the emergency vehicle and the vehicle that was trying to pass, if it was possible for them to move over. Therefore, we're here to ask for your help in amending that law this year. I do have, for those members of the committee that were not part of the transportation finance overview that we did, I have a short video that I would like you to see. What we have is Trooper Joe Erickson, and it really gives you a good idea of what it's like to be a trooper working on the side of the road. And again, thanks to the legislature for allowing us to accept some federal funds that put video cameras in all of our state patrol cars, you're now able to witness that firsthand without actually having to be out there. In this particular case, our trooper is sitting at the side of the road having stopped this vehicle for a violation. What I would like you to do is to keep your eyes on the left side. Very quickly, you will see why it's such a dangerous place. I apologize for the lack of audio. It doesn't seem to be up, but there were a lot of bleeps in that particular segment of video as that vehicle went by. In this particular case, neither the trooper nor the occupants of that vehicle were hurt, and the driver of the vehicle that went by was apprehended. But as you can see, people do not move over when there's an emergency vehicle on the side of the road. I do have one more video to show you that shows the potential on a very busy highway where a driver cannot move over and does not slow down until the very last moment. And in this particular case, I'll try to turn up the volume a little bit so that we can just get it without the video. The vehicle on the side of the road, the car that you see ahead of you, the video, and here comes the truck. That's what happens when people don't slow down until they get right on top of the scene. The video was from a squad that was placed behind the squad car that was ahead. And that particular squad was set up well in advance of the scene, red lights flashing, attempting to slow down traffic as it went past. The law currently says that upon the approach of an emergency vehicle, you shall reduce your speed to an appropriate reduced speed. Appropriate doesn't give anybody real direction. Appropriate sometimes is in the mind of the person who's actually driving the vehicle. It was appropriate for me, but was it appropriate for the conditions? There becomes a disagreement or a difference of opinion. So in our bill, what we're asking for, and we understand that it is a change from the policy of before, where we were just asking for people to move over. In this particular case, we are asking that we at least get them to slow down. The law, as it was written before, required the move over when there were two or more lanes traveling in the same direction. This particular change would require at least a slowdown, even on two-lane roadways, where Trooper Mowers, I think, can give you some additional information on what it's like to be at the side of the road on a two-lane roadway when a vehicle is driving past you at 55 or 60 miles an hour.
Mr. Chair, members, I am Sergeant Kurt Mowers of the Minnesota State Patrol out of Brainerd. I am the public information officer currently. I also work the road many of the times. I still write tickets to and from my presentations where I go. The thing I see a lot out there with my own experiences is one thing. You could have anyone up here if you wanted to, not just from the State Patrol, but from any police department, from any sheriff's office, and you'll get the same response. Every time we start talking about this issue, it's really close to all of our hearts. When we come into this job, we expect to be shot at, maybe not like the first night of my work as a city police officer. I've been an officer in the State Patrol now for almost 21 years, and I was a city police officer for almost 3 years before that. We expect a lot of those hazards, but when there's something that can be done like this bill that can be passed that can help us out, make us safe, and help us to get home to our families, we feel that that's very important. I myself have been hit. I've had brand new squad cars smashed, not just on the interstate, but we have it happen on the two-lane roads. Trooper Joe Erickson, the one video you saw first, that officer was in my rookie school 20 years ago. His dad was a trooper too. And I'm sure that any time we get together, there's always stories that we hear about. Some of these make the news. The stories you just saw made the news. Just talking just last week to some friends of mine and one of my lieutenants, they told me countless stories that I didn't even hear about or know about in my own district where we've had close calls. One trooper just retired a few months ago from the Little Falls area, and he was hit just a few months before he retired. A mirror hit him. Someone that did not slow down, and they went past him, and it spun him around and threw him up on the hood of his car. There's no video on that, and it didn't make the news, and the trooper, fortunately, was all right. But there's many, many, many close calls that we have out there that we will never hear about. And I guess I'd just like to say that this
bill is very, very important for another reason, and that's the slowdown issue that's put in there. People are not slowing down now, and I'm going to tell you they are not moving over either, and it's very critical, I think, that we need to have that lane of separation stated in that bill that Representative Gazelka has put forth, and I really appreciate the honor to be here. It is an honor to be here, and I say that because I'm happy to be here, because I'm able to be here, because I have survived so far, and I have 9 more years left, and I hope to survive, and I think this bill is a good start to that, and thank you very much.
I have a question in that. It doesn't seem like 10 miles an hour is really, if you're going 70, are we talking about 60, or... 65, we're talking about 55. Do I understand that right?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we started at 20. It was working with the DOT to deal with another concern, and that is to make sure that we get traffic flowing properly. And they felt like if it was too much of a slowdown, it could really bottle things up. And the way the legislation is, they can slow down more than 10 miles per hour. Yeah. We just want them to do at least 10 miles per hour.
Well, even that, I'm not going to quibble with Noondot at this point, but that picture of that semi rolling along 10 miles an hour is not making any difference in the hell of these.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Captain Erickson.
Mr. Chair and members, the idea, at least in having it be 10 miles an hour, rather than the appropriate reduced speed, which if you were going at what you thought was an appropriate speed to begin with, you wouldn't have your foot over the brake pedal. We have made the conscious decision to accept the reduction to 10 only because our whole point in putting a speed reduction of a fixed nature in there was telling them that they have to slow down at least 10 miles an hour. It'll take their foot from the gas pedal and put it over the brake pedal, which gives us that extra half second of reaction time to slow things down at least a little bit.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Erickson, two questions. First of all, and I'm sure it's further in statute, but share with us what the penalty for not doing this would be.
Mr. Chair, members, the penalty falls under misdemeanor. The fine is going to range anywhere what a misdemeanor is, depending upon the court. So there is no fine established for this particularly, but it's probably somewhere between $100 and $200.
And, Mr. Chairman, then one more for Captain Erickson. How do you plan to educate drivers from outstate to this particular change?
What's the
Mr. Chair, members, our safety education officers, our public information troopers, as they're now called, have been educating people on this law. We have billboards up in Greater Minnesota talking about the Ted Foss move over law. We believe that we are educating the public right now. The problem is that we've been left with a law that we cannot enforce. That's why we're coming forward with this. We will continue to provide that education using those same venues. And I would stand corrected, it is a petty misdemeanor in terms of the violation currently. Now, in the case of the crashes that were involved, because it was a crash, that would take it into court and there would be other penalties that would ensue.
I think we have the correction. Yeah. Representative Hortman?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about how far over the person is supposed to pull when the trooper or other law enforcement is pulling somebody over. How far off of the roadway? Is there a requirement in the law now of how far off the shoulder you get?
Mr. Chair.
Who's answering that, officer?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now in the statute there is no current foot per se. We just tell people in our information that we want them to move over as far as possible. And some people do stop in the lane of traffic, and then we'll have them adjust, depending on the situation. Certain locations, there isn't many places that they can stop, but that's where we end up having to stop them for whatever reason. But there's no actual footage in the law that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask Captain Erickson, at what point would an approaching driver be required to comply with the reduced speed under Clause 1 in the amendment? Would it be the point where the driver was passing the emergency vehicle?
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Williams, the approaching and before passing the vehicle is original language in that provision, so it would have to take place prior to them passing the vehicle that they would slow down.
I need some adjustments.
Mr. Chairman, Captain Erickson, would it be enforced in such a way that it would be, say, within a certain distance of the stopped vehicle?
Captain Erickson.
Mr. Chair, members, the reality is that when an officer is on the side of the road and he's got his back to the traffic lane, he's probably not going to know, unless there is another officer present. Our whole point is the fact that we enforce this, be able to enforce this provision and see to it that citations are issued may not happen. Because by the time the individual sees the trooper on the side of the road, by the time they see whether or not the individual slows down, they're probably already going to be on them. And then they may see their brake lights after the fact. They're going to recognize, knowing what the speed is on that roadway, and all of our people, and this applies to not only law enforcement officers, but it applies to all emergency workers that work at the side of the roadway. So it would be a fire vehicle on the side of the road. It could be an ambulance on the side of the road. It could be a tow truck for the most part, with their red lights displayed as an emergency vehicle, dealing with a vehicle on the side of the road as well. Now, there are opportunities where another officer might witness that the behavior passing another emergency vehicle, not the police officer involved. But what we're most concerned with is getting most people to understand that they need to slow down, and they need to slow down at least a fixed amount, rather than leaving it at an appropriate reduced speed.
Other questions or comments? If not, Representative Gazaki, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that House File 1164 be passed and referred to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended.
All in favor of that amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. The motion prevails, and the House File 1164 as amended is on its way to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Next item is House File 1401, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have the bill, and I do have a delete all amendment, and so I'll first move the bill 1401, and then I will move the DE1 delete all amendment to put it in the order that we'd like it, and I would move that 1401 be moved to the General Register.
We're going to lay that over, I think, Representative Nelson.
Exactly my thoughts, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill. So, first of all, we are going to move the bill, and now we are going to move the House File, delete all, which is H1401DE1. I think we could incorporate this, but they always get mad at me when I do that. So is there any discussion about that amendment before we vote on that? All in favor? Yes, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, that deletion, if you put in lines 14 through 19, that takes care of that problem with a pickup having a fuel tank or a small fertilizer tank in the back temporarily. Sometimes they go to the field. They wouldn't need to get a commercial license. This federal regulation, that takes care of that, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All in favor of the delete all amendments, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is now before us, and it's position that the author would like, and please proceed with it, and Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and members, it really is a bill that is quite simple. Hear that often, but it truly is something that puts us in parallel with federal codes. And again, Captain Erickson with the State Patrol is here to bring you up to speed and answer questions on it.
Representative Erickson, Captain Erickson, excuse me. I just promoted you and you didn't know it.
Demoted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, Brian Erickson with the State Patrol. The amendment that you see before you is necessary to eliminate some confusion in our current statutes. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations preempted Minnesota's provisions a few years ago, removing some exemptions that were in place. This particular exemption remains in Minnesota statute, and we are essentially trying to clean it up to avoid any confusion. The federal requirements are as listed here, that anything required to be placarded is considered a commercial vehicle for purposes of CDL and registration, and I'll stand for questions.
Are there questions or comments? Well, we might as well move to a vote. Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Nelson?
I'll renew your motion that this be passed, passed and laid over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is...
Thank you.
...going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Bill. Thank you. Next, we have the Metropolitan Airports Commission update with Chairperson Ricky Figwell, along with several of her cohorts, or at least two, if not several. He's the guy with the suntan. I don't.
The bad suntan.
Yeah. Really bad.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting us come today and make this presentation. We have a handout which I will get to in a couple minutes, but essentially I'm not going to do a background on, I'm Vicki Tidwell, I'm Chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Nigel Finney and Jeff Hamill are here with me today. I'm just going to talk about basically three things today, starting with a very general background to let you know how we got to the 2020 vision today, the 2020 vision, and then a little bit on the reliever airports. Some of you may not know that Twin Cities International, or MSP, is the sixth busiest airport in the world. That's measuring it in terms of operations. Last year we had 541,000 operations, which are takeoffs and landings, which gets us almost, which is the busiest year we've had, and our passenger levels are almost back to the 2,000 passenger levels. We're just a little shy of that, and we expect perhaps this year we will in fact be back at the 2,000 passenger levels. In 1996, the state legislature made the decision to keep the airport where it is now, known now I think as the famous dual track study. Part of that decision was to expand at the current site. I think most of you can see what that expansion entailed. We're almost at the end of that $3.1 billion expansion, which included expanding the concourses, adding another parking garage, moving the post office, a brand new Humphrey terminal, many things that you don't necessarily notice because they were behind the scenes improvements, and the final sort of flagship improvement, if you will, at the airport is the opening of the new runway, which is runway 1735. That will open in October. That will then give us four runways, at MSP and will meet our airfield capacity needs well into the future. What we do not have in terms of meeting our capacity needs are adequate gates looking into the future. Projections are that by 2020 we will have 55 million passengers coming through MSP. Right now we have about 33 million. At peak travel times right now we do not have any gates available for existing airlines or new entrants into this market. In September, the governor, along with Richard Anderson, came forward with a proposal to expand the gate capacity at Twin Cities International, which we are calling the 2020 vision. The 2010 plan is the plan that the airport is just completing now. That plan always contemplated additional gate expansion. The 2020 vision now addresses the additional gate expansion at the airport. There were three options that were presented to the commission in January. The first option was to expand the Humphrey Terminal, and I'll get to the materials we handed out. The second option would be to build what's called a midfield terminal. That was one of the options that was considered in 1996. A midfield terminal would be built over by where the FAA tower is now. We would close the entrance from Highway 5 to the airport. The midfield terminal would be constructed. You would access it off Crosstown. And the existing Lindbergh terminal would be turned into two parallel concourses with planes parking on both sides of it. And the third option would be to expand the Lindbergh terminal down the G concourse. One of the reasons that wasn't contemplated in 1996 is because that expansion of the G concourse would go in an area that is now currently occupied by Northwest Airlines, which we call Building B. It's a series of hangars and the old Northwest World Headquarters. The commission recommended going forward with the design phase one of the 2020 vision, which is the expansion of the Humphrey Terminal. I'll just generally speak on the three phases and then go back to the drawings you have before you. Phase one, which is an expansion of the Humphrey Terminal, would cost roughly $135 million, depending on whether or not we add an additional parking facility at the Humphrey Terminal at that time. The Humphrey Terminal was originally built to be expanded, and if you turn to the very first drawing that you have, you see gates 1 through 7, the airplanes are kind of pink. That is the existing expansion that's being contemplated right now. We currently have gates 8 through 15 operational at the Humphrey Terminal. So this would expand the Humphrey Terminal to add gates 1 through 7, and additionally we could add one on the very end there, gate number 18, if we deem it's necessary when we get the forecast in from the airlines of what their growth projections will be. Currently, the commission has voted to authorize the funds to proceed with the design phase one of the Humphrey Terminal. We've asked staff to report back to the commission in June on progress with having the carriers who are not part of the Northwest Airlines SkyTeam Alliance moved over to the Humphrey Terminal. So in other words, at the Lindbergh Terminal would remain Mesaba, Northwest, Delta, and Continental. In addition to the charter airlines that currently operate out of the Humphrey, the other airlines that are at Lindbergh would move over to the Humphrey Terminal. This, of course, is made possible by the opening of light rail in December connecting the Lindbergh Terminal to the Humphrey Terminal. Phase two, as contemplated by, if you turn to the last sheet, which is the green background sheet, phase two, which is anticipated would be needed sometime around 2012-2013, would be an expansion of the existing G concourse. And if you see where the the airplanes begin in black, that first extension down to the purple area would be phase two. That is a little more expensive expansion, around $450 million. It would require a secondary roadway, which would come in on the backside of the parking ramp. It would give passengers a second drop-off point and baggage check-in in addition to the Lindbergh terminal, and would allow someone, if they had access to the Internet and knew what gate they were leaving from, if they were leaving from one of the gates farthest to that side of the terminal, they would be able to be dropped off there, check their bags, and then proceed to either the new H concourse or out on the very end of the ABCD concourse, as you see it where all those little planes are in the little satellite terminal separated on the ABCD concourse. Phase 3, which is contemplated sometime around 2015, is where you see the red planes. It's that red extension. It's an additional extension to the H concourse. There would be a people mover that would run from the main lobby of the Lindbergh terminal all the way along the G concourse, because it's quite a long walk, as you can see, allowing passengers to travel and have several stops along the way. So their walk would not be as long as it appears now. The little purple, I guess, quadrangle that you see there would be a vacant space where we could have development for a hotel, should there be a developer that thought the pro formas worked and they wanted to come forward with a proposal for a hotel. Additionally, the new roadway there would allow people who aren't traveling to the airport to access that hotel. That's not something that we contemplate the airport authority would do. It's something we contemplate would be a private enterprise endeavor. This expansion, one of the, I think the great benefits of this expansion is that it's ultimately scalable. It can be done in phases as it is needed. The midfield terminal, which is really our only other serious option for expansion at this time, would require significant changes to Cedar Avenue, we believe, and the Crosstown Highway. It would cost about $1.7 billion and would be a significant disruption to air travel at MSP. This particular plan does not disrupt service to the passenger at MSP and is at least half the cost of the midfield terminal plan. Mm-hmm. If you want to turn to the middle page, I'd like you to sort of imagine with us what the Humphrey Terminal eventually could look like. This isn't what we believe the Humphrey Terminal will look like in 2007, which is when we would like to complete phase one, but what it will look like in the future as air service by non-SkyTeam airlines increases at MSP. This would expand the Humphrey Terminal to 29 gates. As you can see, it would wrap around and go all the way around to the end there. And 29 gates, in airport language, is a very serious terminal. Some people have referred to the Humphrey Terminal as a secondary terminal and inferior to the Lindbergh. And while you will not have at the Humphrey Terminal all of the shopping amenities that you have at the Lindbergh Terminal, because still the bulk of the passengers will be coming into the Lindbergh Terminal, that terminal alone would be bigger than many airport terminals that serve major cities in the United States: Nashville, Austin, a couple of the terminals at Phoenix. So one of the things I want to dispel today is the notion that in itself the Humphrey Terminal is an inferior facility. It's a beautiful facility. It was built for a growing Sun Country, which fell on some rough times and ended up not meeting its business plan. It has sat virtually empty at many times of the day and currently incurs a $5 million a year operating loss if you take the Humphrey Terminal and the parking garage. This 2020 plan would help us maximize the use of that facility and would erase the operating loss, which we think is a very attractive thing, part of this phase one. Coming before us in the next month will be a recommendation by staff that we authorize some design work for the addition of the Humphrey Garage, the second addition to the Humphrey Garage, and that would address a very important component for us of the difficulty of getting from the light rail station at the Humphrey Terminal into the Humphrey Terminal. Right now, you have to walk outside. I think we all have seen people arriving at MSP in January from nice, warmer locations in shorts and Bermudas, probably not anticipating that they might have to go outside. Having said that, there is very little transfer between the airlines that currently fly out of the Humphrey Terminal or will fly out of the Humphrey Terminal under this proposal and the SkyTeam Alliance. If you are connecting through MSP, chances are you are coming in on a Northwest partnered airline. Just a few more things about MSP that sort of people don't necessarily know about, but we are the only airport in the country that is the home airport to four airline companies, Sun Country, Northwest, Mistralba, and Champion. We are also the number one rated airport in the country for all kinds of customer service and concession rewards, and in fact last year received an award as the best domestic airport in both North and South America. So the airport, really through the great direction of Jeff Hamill, has received high accolades all over the world for the efficiency with which it is run and for the ease with which the passenger is able to get to their planes. We think the 2020 vision, and particularly phase one, will be a continuance of that, that it will be great ease for the passenger. We believe the airlines who move over to the Humphrey Terminal wouldn't be dragged back for anything. It's proximity to the new runway. It's proximity to the parking ramp. And, in fact, it will likely be a cheaper place to operate from than the Lindbergh Terminal. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go on with my two other points or pause and see if there's any questions on the 2020 vision?
Yes, Mr. Well, I'm going to ask you, the first picture here, is it to the right, the pink planes that are the new gates that you're adding there? Mm-hmm. And you're adding the gray area, you're going to add a secondary parking ramp in gray, is that what's going on here?
That's it. Phase one are the pink planes, which are 1 through 7, and then number 18 tucked around on the corner, and then the gray additional parking ramp. And we won't know for certain if we'll add 18 yet until we receive the forecast back from the airlines. Sun Country is anticipating, as they've advised us, this vision was done estimating a 3% growth in passenger activity. Sun Country believes that they will grow faster than that. And so we may need that gate number 18 sooner rather than later. And you don't add a gate at a time, so you add gates kind of in groups. So we may be adding that one. The parking ramp, the gray parking ramp, is the addition, which isn't there now. And you can see at the edge there where light rail stops.
Is that, when does the second parking ramp come to the floor? When, as you add all the ramps, or first, or?
It was going to authorize it. Well, before us tomorrow is actually a recommendation from staff to authorize the design work. It is anticipated, and I didn't bring these graphs with me, that we'll need that ramp sooner rather than later, so it is likely to be done with the phase one program, which would have it opening in June of 07.
Okay. And when you go to the second picture here, you and the cars on 494 are both using the same runway as you come around the corner. Is there any more room there?
Well, we don't have an overall airport map, but the Humphrey Terminal is quite...
That would help when you make a presentation like this, I think.
To have an overall airport map. Sorry about that. The Humphrey Terminal isn't anywhere close to 494 there. In fact, the buildings right along 494, there are the Northwest Building C hangars. The Humphrey Terminal is situated more towards a quarter of a mile north of 494.
And your fourth picture, the light area, I assume, is... I just have... I wonder if there's going to be room for cars and people to get in here. As the airplane is going under or over, and as you drive across the... You can still get in, have access to this place.
Mr. Chairman, that white area is currently an occupied site right now by... when you're leaving the terminal, there's a big building in front of you that has a Northwest plane painted on it. Yeah. That is the Building B complex. That is all currently occupied space right now. Northwest is vacating that space, has been vacating it over the last year and consolidating to different places on the airport.
Okay.
So that would occupy what is already occupied areas.
Is that some of the buildings that we're hearing about there where your maintenance goes on? Okay. Representative Beard, do you have a...
Two questions, Mr. Chair, if I may. Ms. Tigwell, on page one, once again, the second ramp, the right by the light rail station, when do you anticipate that to be completed? I missed that date on here.
Well, we're thinking like we'll need it in June of 07. So that is a new matter coming before the commission tomorrow.
Correct.
But that isn't something we anticipated as part of phase one, but as one of the unique things about the Humphrey Terminal is almost all of those passengers are origination passengers, meaning they're going to want to drive out there and park their car. 60% of the passengers who fly through MSP are connecting from somewhere else. Those passengers will be continuing to fly through the Lindbergh terminal, but all of these passengers, because they're on the charter airlines or they're on the non-alliance airlines, are most likely starting their journey right here, necessitating parking.
Regarding that parking ramp, if I may, one more question about that before I switch subjects. The folks that are running the Hiawatha Light Rail, I think they shared a concept that maybe there would be park and ride passes sold by the MAC and some of those spaces let out so we could use that station for our commuter station. Is that a revenue stream you're anticipating too? Do you know about this? Am I breaking news to you?
I might kick this over to Nigel, but I don't believe we've ever felt we had enough excess capacity for this to be a park and ride. We have filled the Humphrey Terminal with some employee parking to sort of bridge that multi-million dollar deficit. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, there have been discussions with the Hiawatha Project about use of that facility. However, on the day that we move the other carriers to the Humphrey Terminal, we'll move 2,400 parkers into that facility. That essentially means that with the existing demand, with the employees who park there, and with those additional parkers, there will be no excess capacity during the majority of the year to accommodate light rail parkers.
Thank you. Changing the subject back to the SkyTeam concept, describe that to us again a little more clearly. Who is that? Is it a corporate entity, and is that subject to change going forward in the future?
Ms. Tigwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The SkyTeam is a code-sharing alliance between Continental, Delta, and Northwest, and then the Saba, who feeds into, is a regional carrier feeding into Northwest flights. Whether or not that, I suppose it's always subject to change, but that's really up to the airlines, not up to the MAC. I think that the point I wanted to make was there is very little passenger transfer between everyone else at the airport and the SkyTeam Alliance. On average, only 50 bags a day move between non-SkyTeam members and SkyTeam members, and that is out of 33 million passengers a year.
That's pretty significant. But I guess my question is, if one falls out of favor and the SkyTeam mix changes in 17 years or 13 years or a handful of years from now, can we accommodate that? Are we going to have somebody, is there going to be a moving day, or is there an anticipation of that happening being a problem, or is it no problem?
Ms. Tigwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think one of the important things for airports is they have to be dynamic. They have to be able to change with the times. If someone falls out of the SkyTeam Alliance, then the rationale for connecting into the remaining SkyTeam members probably falls away, too. Mm-hmm. So they become more of a point-to-point carrier than a connecting carrier. But, you know, I think one thing that's clear to all of us is there's a lot of uncertainty in the aviation business. Thank you. And as Jeff Hamill just reminded me, one of the things we are doing with the Lindbergh Terminal is adding many gates to it. So we could, right now Northwest has to give up, I think, up to 6 gates upon notice to accommodate another carrier at the airport. And so if that other airline wanted to stay at the Lindbergh, they would already be there. So I don't think that we would kick them out, but that will happen a long time from now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Governor Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the MAC for coming. We're all familiar with each other, our noise-impacted neighbors and the airport. But I, my question is not so much about that, although we could probably get into that later. You had mentioned, Ms. Sigwell, about the $5 million operating loss for the current Humphrey terminal, and it got me thinking about the airline industry right now as we speak today. Seems that what I've heard is in the next couple of 3 years we'll really know the fate of a lot of the legacy carriers. You know, again, we have record oil prices now, similar to what we had last year, and I just wonder, contemplating such a huge expansion with a lot of dollars involved in this, in this industry environment, it seems quite risky to me. And I, over the summer, I did some traveling, you know, down to St. Louis. I saw, you know, American has significantly reduced their operations there. So you go to Lambert Field, and you know, half the gates are just not used. I was also at BWI, and U.S. Air is scaling back operations. Half the airport isn't used. I worry that we hope for Northwest success. We want this to remain, you know, a hub and a viable area. But you know, in this environment, are we in danger of becoming another, you know, BWI or St. Louis or some of these other airports with huge underutilized capacity? Would it be more prudent, perhaps, to wait a couple of years to see how things shake out in the airline industry?
Ms. Tuba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's another question you have to ask yourself, which is, what if we don't do this expansion? There's a million more people that are going to be moving into the Twin Cities over the next 15 years, according to projections. They have to fly. Where are they going to fly out of if we don't have gates to accommodate them? One of the things driving this expansion is the change in the fleet mix, the use of regional jets. We're the fastest growing market in the country for regional jets. Regional jets require, instead of one plane servicing an area, you might have two regional jets servicing it, so you need more gates. Clearly, none of us, I think, would be willing to make a prediction today on even if in 2 years we'll know the state of the aviation business. The loan that was made to Northwest Airlines in the 90s by the state of Minnesota and by the MAC requires them to keep a hub here. It requires them to keep their headquarters here. So in terms of Northwest Airlines, I think we're confident that we have their committed presence here. But we also have to remember that most of our passengers come from somewhere else. They're feeding into here. And this is one of the circumstances where, you know, if you will, regional isolation might work to our favor, because if you're in the Dakotas or Montana, parts of Iowa or even Wisconsin, and you want to go anywhere, you have to go somewhere else first. There was just a study that was done on what, which we had done by our it's not our bond counsel, but Don Brown, who, our financial consultant, that talks about what percentage of our connecting traffic will come here no matter what happens. And it's 25% of our connecting traffic. So when we look at our sensitivity studies on funding these options, they are done on sort of a worst-case scenario. Phase one we can do, should we choose to do that, without borrowing any additional funds. We won't be adding to the MAC debt load if that's the way we choose to go forward. Phase two is not contemplated for 7 years. Hopefully we will have a better look at the state of the airline industry in 7 years. Phase three is not contemplated until around 2015. Hopefully we all have a more stable aviation industry by then.
Thank you. Just one last question. Again, my concern is about, you know, that we're putting in some very ambitious plans, I think, in a very rapid way without, again, I think adequately looking at this economic environment, but also the issue of an environmental impact statement. And I appreciate Mr. Finney and I had a good conversation about that the other day. But there's some major environmental questions here. It's not only the noise. You know, I learned here today that these major road reconfigurations are a possibility. You probably have an increase in the de-icing materials that have to be used with more aircraft. And it just seems that this rises to the need for an EIS rather than a simple environmental awareness worksheet. Now, that would only add you know, maybe 6 months to a year to the process. You'd have a more in-depth study. You'd have more opportunities for public involvement. You know, why not do that? I think as a sign to the community that you're interested in looking at some of these questions a little more seriously and in a little more depth. It seems like a reasonable thing to do, and I'm just wondering why not do an environmental impact statement? This is a pretty major expansion.
Ms. Tegel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to take issue with the somehow this is a hurried thing. GAIF expansion was contemplated back in 1996 when the dual-track study was done. The opening of the runway addressed the airfield capacity issues. It was not, I think, believed in 1996 that the airport was as big as it was ever going to get, or it certainly wouldn't have been kept there. The Humphrey Terminal in itself, which is phase one, has a vacant space to the side of it that was left that way so it could be expanded, as is the area where the second parking ramp would go. So somehow that this expanding gates is new, I just don't think it's true. I think 8 years ago it was considered. What was considered, though, was a midfield terminal, which fortunately we don't have to do because that would be very disruptive and very expensive. I'm going to throw this to Nigel to respond to the EIS question.
Mr. Finney?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harnstein, the Commission has committed to doing a federal environmental assessment and a state environmental assessment worksheet for phases one and two of this development. As Chair Tidwell indicated, the Commission in 1996 to 1998 did a full state EIS and a full federal EIS related to the airfield improvements, which looked at the increases in the runway capacity, additional activity on the runways. That also looked at issues such as de-icing and additional glycol, and for that reason we've constructed three de-icing pads to capture the glycol, and we'll be doing a fourth de-icing pad with this development program. But you have to keep in mind what we're proposing to do at the Humphrey Terminal is build seven or eight additional gates on a base of about 120 gates. So we're essentially transferring activity from one terminal to another terminal, and we will go through the environmental assessment process to determine whether or not there are issues that rise to the level of those that have to be evaluated in an EIS. If that is the case, then I'm sure the Commission will be in a position of doing an EIS. But at this point, we are really focusing on the terminal development itself.
Ms. Stigler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one additional thing I'd like to add is over the next couple of years, Northwest Airlines has options or orders for 295 planes. And we would like to see some of those planes here at MSP serving the community. We can't do that right now. We just don't have any more gates to offer anyone. And I also want everyone to keep in mind that one of the things regional jets do is they offer service to communities that without a regional jet wouldn't have air service because they don't have enough people there to fill a full-size plane. I think that airports, while they're obviously a transportation hub, they're economic development tools also, and I think that's a very important point for all of us to recognize. We just updated an economic impact study that was done in 1998. We had a little bit of publicity on it, but if you didn't see it, we'd be happy to get you more information. 153,000 jobs are in the airport and related visitor industries. There's nearly $6 billion in personal income that flows as a result of the airport and $10.7 billion in business revenue. I don't think we can underestimate the importance for economic development of a viable airport in the Twin Cities that is able to meet the growing passenger demand. And the one other thing I just want to mention is that the growth projections in this plan are the same growth projections that we've had virtually all along. In fact, they're even a little more conservative, of 3% passenger growth a year. So they're not a sudden, oh, let's project something bigger. We think they're reliable, modest growth projections.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hill, Mr. Hamill, I was speaking with the gentleman today regarding issues of the airport, and because I sit on the subcommittee with Representative Beard and others, concern came up to us about security, and I have a daughter that's in intelligence, and the gentleman I was talking with was in intelligence, and you talked about expanding the gates here and just looking at airports in general across the nation. Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is a very strategically located place within the confines of the United States, and so we're rated high in the scheme of things from a military standpoint, from a private standpoint, and I'm just wondering your consideration from the MAC standpoint or from the airport standpoint in regards to security and how you work with Homeland Security and things like that as you delve into moving into the direction of adding new gates and new expansions out there. What is your plan, or how are we looking at the security situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, we work very, very closely with the Transportation Security Administration, which is part of Homeland Security. At the federal level, Minneapolis-St. Paul enjoys, I think, a very favorable reputation of having one of the most efficient security screening processes in the land. We have a very, very efficient operation within the terminal building. Ken Kasprison, who is the federal security director assigned to Minneapolis-St. Paul, is, I think, in my opinion, a very aggressive and a very involved leader in that organization. He has been called to Washington and has taken the Minneapolis-St. Paul knowledge to Washington as part of a process of developing national procedures for security screening and processing. We overall, quite frankly, think that we're positioned very, very conveniently for growth and expansion at Minneapolis-St. Paul. We believe that the security considerations are all part of the overall integral plan coordinated with the TSA. While all airports are faced with certain levels of threat, we think that Minneapolis-St. Paul is positioned to deal with and handle any threat situation environment thrown at us. It's not to say we don't have certain vulnerabilities. We do. We're constantly improving those security vulnerabilities and making certain that, in fact, we're better prepared to respond. We have probably one of the strongest working relationships with the TSA of any airport in the country, and our reputation is sound in that regard. We constantly work for our police department and our law enforcement agencies, with our fire department, with the TSA, develop security plans and programs, work with the military on the airfield, and we think that we are properly positioned to deal with this growth and expansion, which, quite frankly, as Mr. Finney indicated, is not dramatic expansion in comparison to the grand scheme of the facility.
Follow-up question to Mr. Hamill and Ms. Tewell. The concern in the conversation was not just Minneapolis-St. Paul, but the surrounding metropolitan airports that fall within the MAC jurisdiction. And the concern is the security levels out there that coincide within the MAC's jurisdiction. And there was a concern as far as security situations dealing with other airports. Can you address that issue at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the really rare airports, of which there are six in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area that are operated by the Metropolitan Airports Commission, primarily cater to the needs of smaller aircraft, with the exception of St. Paul Downtown Airport. For the most part, from a security standpoint, and this has been discussed pretty extensively with the TSA and with Homeland Security,
the smaller airplanes, other than a corporate jet, don't pose a significant threat to the operation of air transportation facilities in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. In other words, a single-engine, privately operated, propeller-driven airplane, even loaded with explosives and used as a weapon, is going to have relatively minimal impact on the operation of our airport system. Having said that, we do coordinate with the local law enforcement agencies. Each municipal police department within which each of our airports are located are coordinated with our staff. There are emergency response plans. We do monitor and keep track of the airports, and while they are accessible, easy access to runway environments and so forth is monitored with new gate systems that have gone in, fencing, and at St. Paul downtown in particular, there's been an enhanced security system at that airport, primarily because of its focus on corporate jet aviation activity. We believe, however, the relief airports have been improved, will continue to be improved as potential problems do develop or additional threats are identified in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And excuse me, I have a little cold. Also, thanks to folks from MAC for coming today. Appreciate it. If you put an estimate on the entire 2020 plan, let me wrap a couple questions up in one here. What is the cost, and how will it be paid for? And then what portion of that will require legislative approval?
In today's dollars, Chair. In today's dollars, the estimated cost is about $720 million. We anticipate paying for that with a combination of passenger facility charges, MAC concession revenue, federal funds, and we will leverage some of those through a bonding authority. I don't believe any of it requires legislative approval. I believe that the part that required legislative approval was the building of a midfield terminal, which we are not going to do, and we're prohibited from any land banking anywhere. Just so everyone knows, MAC's jurisdiction is 35 miles from City Hall, which at one point was considered the metropolitan area, Minneapolis and St. Paul City Hall. So what we have not decided on which part of the financing plan we're going to do first. We're waiting for that to come back from staff. We haven't authorized any of the construction yet, and when we do that, we will take an overall comprehensive look at how much we want to use to pay as we go. We receive federal funds from entitlement funds. We're always in competition for discretionary funds from the FAA, and we'll wait to see the recommendation from staff on how we should go forward with phase 1, 2, and 3. But I did just want to make the point that we believe we can pay for phase 1 without any additional borrowing.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Larson.
Yeah, and Chair Tigwell, and I hope the committee is hearing that, $720 million in publicly collected funds that won't have any legislative approval from elected officials. I think that's an issue that perhaps needs to be addressed as we look to the future. But what if the projections are wrong? What if the plan that the consultants have come with and Northwest has come with are wrong, and the resources aren't there once we've committed those resources? Presumably it's backed up by full faith and credit of somebody. Who is that?
Mr. Chairman, first I'd like to say that MAC has a pretty good track record for meeting its budget targets and its construction projects. Secondly, this is a three-phase program. If you don't need phase two, you don't have to do phase two. They are completely separated from each other. You can do phase one when it's needed. Phase two, you would contemplate it and go forward with it when it's not only needed, but as funds are available for it, as is the case with phase three. But I just want to go back to where the funds at MAC come from. Our operating expenses at the MAC are covered through a combination of rates and charges to the airlines and the concessions that are collected from the MAC. Our construction is funded from a variety of sources, including PFCs, federal funds that we receive. We don't receive taxpayer dollars, per se, from the general fund. We do receive about $1.4 million a year from a MnDOT Aviation Fund, which I'm sure you know is a fund that's received from various taxes, if you will, and fees on airplanes around the state of Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Representative Larson.
Chair Tigwell, perhaps we get caught up in the semantics. I think especially in the transportation area, you would find that while when you look at how we collect money for transportation at the gas pump, some would say, well, that's not really a tax, that's a user fee. But yet, throughout state government, those are taxpayer dollars, essentially, that go back to the legislature for appropriation. My goal isn't to settle that issue today. That's not, I think it's just a point for members to consider as we look at proposals this large. I think that the answer is that if, in fact, we do get obligated and are not able to meet our obligations, it is the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota that it would have to step up to meet shortfalls, and I think that we all ought to think about that. The second question that I have relates to the noise issue. And you know, over time, that I'm extremely concerned about the impacts that this facility, with the new runway opening later this year, will have on the constituents in my district. And you talk about the million new people in the region, the jobs, the economic engine. Those things are all correct, and I think that it is important to have a vibrant airport. What commitment with this 2020 proposal will come forward as it relates to noise and meeting on obligation? And we may have a difference of opinion on whether MAC meets its obligations or not, at least as it relates to noise. But will you have a proposal that extends out to the communities that surround the airport, and so that the communities that surround the airport can consider the Metropolitan Airports Commission a friendly neighbor?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Tigwell.
As you know, and but some of the committee members may not know, the noise mitigation program at the airport is done through the FAA through a program called the Part 150 program. The airport is required to produce noise contour maps that are forward-looking by 5 years. The map that we are currently operating under is submitted to the FAA for approval are the 2007 contours. The Phase 1 expansion of the Huntley Terminal, in fact, contemplates a slower growth rate than the 2007 contours contemplate. So it will not affect the 2007 contours at all. The 2007 contours also take into account the opening of the new runway in October. So those are already contemplated in the maps and the mitigation through 2007. The way the system works through the FAA is in 2007, MAC will have to begin to draft and publish 2012 contours. So they will be forward-looking for projections of passengers and fleet mix and traffic for the years from 2007 through 2012. So they're not incompatible. In fact, they're very much in sync.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. If I did. Mr. Chair and
Representative Larson.
So is it fair to say then that that there is no plan for growing the package to homeowners that surround the airport, and as we look forward out the 5 years, but with all the new traffic, we'll stay within the current Part 150 program, presuming it stays the same at the federal level?
Ms. Tigwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The addition of the Huntley Terminal will not impact adversely the 2007 contours, which is 2 years from now. In 2 years, we will have to draw new contours going through 2012. So there won't be a change. They won't impact. The addition of the Huntley Terminal doesn't change the noise contour map, if that is your question. If the second question is, are we currently contemplating changing the noise mitigation program? It is the one we have submitted to the FAA is under review. We have not heard back from them. And when we hear back from them, it's our intention at this point to implement that program unless it's rejected by the FAA.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't take too much of the committee's time on this, but as you know, the folks that surround the airport don't see the package that's been submitted to the federal government as a package at all and as a solution at all. In fact, it's seen as a departure from what the legislature intended in 1996 and a real disturbing development for folks that live around the airport. I have one additional question, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to address, and this has come up at from constituents that I've talked to that have tried to going through the process at the MAC. One of the things that members might not know, if you haven't gone to a Metropolitan Airports Commission meeting, where some of these decisions are made, they're actually held within the terminal at MSP. And those of you who use air travel, you know that that's no small task, getting inside the terminal at MSP. You have to have a boarding pass. You go through security. Well, that's what the public has been required to go through just to go to a public meeting. And similar, if they wanted to go to a public meeting here at the state capitol, they would have to go through that. You can imagine a lot of people just kind of throw their hands in the air and say, oh, forget it. I'm wondering if you see that as an issue, a concern, and if so, how do you plan to address it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I try and begin every commission meeting we have with asking people whether or not they had difficulty getting there. You don't need a boarding pass to come to a commission meeting. We have signs all over the terminal directing people where to go. They get a pass. They go through an expedited security line. Their parking is complimentary. So I think we make all of the efforts that we can to accommodate people, and by the attendance at some of our meetings, I'd say most people are able to routinely get through the issue. We don't have another facility, frankly, where we could meet, and I don't know that it's necessarily incompatible for airport commissioners to meet at the airport. We aren't currently contemplating. We have public meetings frequently off-site from the airport. We'll have them at a hotel or at a school gymnasium when there are issues in which there's a great deal of public interest or there are public hearing, but at the moment we don't have plans to meet somewhere else.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make a brief comment. I'm disappointed to hear that. I think really, if you think about the decisions, we are hearing today that $720 million in public funds will be committed forward, and that now we won't have any enhancement at all of noise mitigation, which I know Representative Hornstein and I are particularly concerned about. I think there will be other neighbors of the airport when that runway opens that will be equally as concerned. And all of those decisions are being made in a facility within the boundaries that you'd have to go if you were going to fly these days. And quite honestly, I don't know of any other level of government that would get away with holding public meetings when clearly you could hold them in a classroom, you could hold them in other places, or you could have planned ahead and said, you know, maybe it won't work to have public meetings at a place that's difficult to get to. Even as easy as Chair Tigwell outlined, is driving to the airport, parking, and for your complimentary parking, traveling into the terminal, being searched by federal security, and then being led up to a meeting room scares off an enormous amount of people as it is. I think a lot of people never leave their living room knowing that that's what they might have to go through. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence today. This is an issue that's very important to me and very important to my constituents, and I appreciate your having the committee take the time to address it.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions here. Is this plan, as you wrote it out, does it require more roads and bridges into your facilities here, infrastructure? And does the state have to come in and rebuild the paths of...
Mr. Chair, no, it doesn't. The 2020 vision, that's actually one of the advantages of it over a midfield terminal, which would require some significant construction of probably Cedar and definitely Crosstown, definitely Crosstown. I mentioned that in phase two or three, there would be a MAC roadway change, which is maybe a 2012 to 2015, if those phases even go forward. Phase one, which is simply the Humphrey Terminal expansion, does not require that.
You're not abandoning the Weaver airports in any way by spending the money on this. Is that possible, or is that contemplated?
No, contemplating abandoning the Weaver airports is not one of our issues, and that was one of the other topics I wanted to just briefly cover today. In the 1996 decision to expand the airport, it was thought that reliever airports would need to be enhanced to as an incentive to keep traffic off MSP. One of the interesting things, though, about the reliever airports is that their operations have declined every year for the last, at least 8 years and maybe longer. What we are considering right now is first building the dike at Holman Field. That airport has had 100-year floods 3 times in the last 10 years. The last time it was shut down for 3 months. We were told by the businesses there that they really couldn't take another one of those. That is our principal corporate reliever airport, and I think, as you know, there are some funds in a bonding bill, $2 million that were in the governor's and the Senate's version of a bonding bill. One of the other things we've done, though, was try and look for other funds. The reliever airports have no source of capital of their own, period. They're just, you simply cannot pass on those costs to the tenants. There aren't enough of them. It would be burdensome for them. So one of the things that I really try to encourage us to do is look elsewhere for funds, look for different funding partners. The dike at Holman Field, I believe, is a great leverage play for the Airports Commission. We are hopefully getting $5.5 million this year to do an underground drainage system at Holman Field, which is something we need to do in order to build the dike. Some local partnership, I think some of you know, the 3M company has contributed $1 million to that project. MAC already has a couple $1 million in funds in there, and we hope to get the last piece from the federal government. So I've tried to make us more creative about where we get our funds other than just MSP funds going to reliever airports. Tomorrow we have before us a very innovative proposal from Anoka County to add capacity to the Anoka County Airport, and we'll be contemplating that. So we aren't abandoning the reliever airports, but the reliever airports contemplated $100 million in improvements with declining operations. And so one of we have a commissioner, Jack Lanners, who is looking at the reliever airports issue, is going to come back to us hopefully in June with a recommendation on prioritizing the projects at the reliever airports, identifying funding sources, and then putting it before the commission for a vote.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tigwell, 2 years ago, Northwest Airlines sued the MAC for a $3 million a year alleged subsidy to the reliever airports. Do you contemplate them suing you over a $5 million a year subsidy to the Humphrey Terminal? Is that driving the plans at all?
Ms. Tigwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I try not to speculate on what Northwest Airlines might or might not do. I believe that re-examining how the reliever airport's capital funding program is done was long overdue. That simply shoveling $100 million from MSP to the reliever airports wasn't the only way to fund capital expansion at the reliever airports. St. Paul Airport alone, $25 million. 3 years ago, we would have just paid for that out of MAC funds. We've got a partnership going. We've got a public partnership, a private partnership, a state partnership, a federal partnership. I think that's a better way for us to approach reliever airports. Whether Northwest Airlines continues their lawsuit, which they lost on procedural matters, I have no clue.
Mr. Chair, to pursue the funding thing just a little bit, and some of us are gravely concerned about the direction you've taken with the funding of the reliever airports, particularly the capital portion, because a reading of the statutes that enable and create the Metropolitan Airports Commission seem to indicate that the legislature empowered you with several funding mechanisms and charged you with running 7 airports as one system. And I'm failing to see where legislative policy, which I think we set here, allows you to somehow differentiate between the capital funds. When this report comes back from Mr. Lanners, can we anticipate you coming back here and asking us for a change in the policy or recommendations, or how are you planning on proceeding with this?
Ms. Tigwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're going to wait and see what Mr. Lanners comes back with, and if you're still here. If that's in June or July, I'd be happy to come back here. I guess part of what I would ask everyone to think about is whether or not declining operations on six airports is a good use of $100 million, and how many people are receiving the benefit of that. And that's the issue we're really wrestling with. What is the priority? What is the... They're relievers, which means they relieve traffic from MSP. And, you know, in fact, all of them don't relieve traffic from MSP, but that's a very important component of it. And I think a funding component from MSP for the relievers is very appropriate. I'm not sure it's $100 million, though. And I'm not sure there aren't other partnerships, including federal funds, which we have never made any genuine effort to get, aren't a better way for us to go. So I'd be happy to come back here and talk to you about it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking forward to engaging that discussion. So just so the members know, this is a huge change in the paradigm of how the MAC has always operated the airport system that they're charged in operating with. So I can hardly wait for this report, and I'm going to be asking this committee to hear us out on whether or not this is a policy that's good for the region and good going forward. And I think it has a direct bearing on why operations are declining at the reliever airports. I don't know that there's... I think there is a cause and effect here that's been happening over the last several years that I'd be happy to make the case for this team. Thank you.
Representative Roy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members from the MAC. Overall, I have some concerns about the expansion, but I think it's a very good thing overall, but I got to preface that with... my being a Northwest employee. I'm on the bottom line, though, so I'm not on the decision-making end of that organization. But just a couple of comments. You mentioned on one of your graphs here showing the hotel, and I really think you need to really seriously look at that quicker, you know, not pushing that out to 2020. And I don't know what point you said, but it doesn't, I just hope, I just encourage you to look at it earlier in your plans. To me, that is something that would definitely be an asset to the airport. It would be, I think it would be like printing money. And it's, you know, with the nature of that business, it's, you know, with the weather events that happen, it doesn't necessarily have to be a weather event that happens here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It could happen somewhere else. And it's one thing, it's frustrating for me to see a lot of people shacked up for the night in the airport, and you look on the screens and they'll say hotel's full or whatever. So I just think it would be a really a nice addition to the airport, and I'm certain that you could make a lot of money off that. And just maybe you could answer a question. I'd heard that maybe Southwest is going to be coming, and are they looking at the Humphrey? And I'm just curious about that. And then just more on a more lighter note, I just wondering if you wanted to do an employee evaluation of Mr. Seibert over there. And we'd be eager to hear your evaluation of him as a MAC employee. Thank you.
I am a voting member.
Representative, is there, you looking for an answer or just making a...
Well, Southwest, I was curious about
that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hamill has been talking to Southwest Airlines for many years now, and the only interest they have ever shown is in going to the Humphrey Terminal, so this would not be a necessarily deterrent for them. But the exciting thing that's happened is ATA Services, MSP, and they've signed a code-sharing agreement, which is kind of similar to the alliance Northwest has with Delta and Continental, and they've signed a code-sharing agreement with Southwest out of Midway, so ATA would fly here to Midway, and then presumably you could hook up to a, do they say 45 destinations out of Midway to any of the Southwest destinations, 45 destinations out of Midway. So that in itself will give travelers more choices, and we are eagerly waiting for ATA's gate requests to see what kind of expansion they might be anticipating here.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Tigwell, Mr. Hamill. If I remember taking a tour of the airport, there was some mention of your and reference to the noise level out at the airport, as Mr. Larson mentioned. Don't you have an insulation package already in place, or what is the insulation package that you have available to for the airport, for the surrounding area? How big is it? Is it adequate? I mean, are we, how, in relationship to other airports, where do we fit in as far as the the insulation package we offer to our local residents.
Ms. Tugma.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. To date, the airport has spent about $341 million in home insulation property, some property acquisition, and in schools, insulating schools. That was for homes that were in the 1996 contour, which was the commitment that was made when the decision was made to keep the airport where it was. That was a very customized package for each home. It involved generally windows, doors, insulation, central air conditioning, encouraging people in summer months to keep their windows closed because when you open the window, you basically eliminate any of the mitigation benefits that you received. I think it's fair to say, first of all, it's a voluntary program under the FAA. There are many airports in the country, for example, Miami, that hasn't insulated a single home, regardless of where they are. Memphis, which has the largest noise contours in the country because night flights are count double, and that's where FedEx is based, settled with 25,000 homeowners for $25 million. We spent $225 million on about 7,500 homes. With the new contours, which contemplates the opening of the new runway, those are the 2007 contours, we are offering the same package that was offered to the 96 homeowners in the, we'll call it just a 65 noise level exposure. It's more complicated than that. But that same package will be available to people in the 65 noise level contour and higher. For people in the next component, which was the 60 to the 64 noise level exposure, there was not a consensus among anyone at the commission on what the right package was to go forward. I think it's fair to say that we didn't believe that a home that was 4 miles from the airport should receive the same noise insulation package that a home 250 feet from the airport received. As a result, for the homes in the 60 to the 64, we approved a noise mitigation package that is a central air conditioning package only that has a homeowner copay that declines as you get in the noisier contours. In other words, it's 50% at 60 and I think 10% at 64. That program is before the FAA now, waiting for their approval or return to the Airports Commission.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Tigwell, how do we compare with other airports with this insulation package?
Well, there is...
Are we number one, number two, number three, 10?
The noise mitigation that has, Mr. Chairman, that has been done at MSP is equaled by no airport and exceeded, equaled by some and exceeded by none. I think that is a very fair statement. There is not an airport in the country that has a comprehensive noise mitigation program of any kind for homes in the 60 to the 64 DNL. We will be very much pioneers in that area. There are some homes around a few airports that received some mitigation that fall in the 60 to the 64 because they had previously been higher, but this is the most comprehensive noise mitigation program in the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got Reverend Horsley and Cedar and Larson on the list, but before they get up to that, I was going to ask, did I read something about you were considering or somebody was considering a casino for the airport property somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a bill introduced by Phyllis Kahn.
Okay, I mean, but is the MAC considering that?
No.
Are there any tribes that would like to get in on the action out there? You know?
I don't know of any.
No, ma'am, I don't. Okay. Representative Hornsby.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I, Representative Lilly's question prompted an additional question I had that I wanted to ask. It's my understanding that Northwest has something like 82% of the capacity here, the 82% of the flights. And I think our fares are, I think only Delta's presence in Cincinnati with high fares in Cincinnati is higher than we are. I'm concerned that this expansion, you know, I'd like your take on how these the other competitors of Northwest feel about moving to the Humphrey Institute and Humphrey Institute. They should move there. No, we should have an aviation program at the Humphrey Institute, the Humphrey Terminal. How they feel about that, and are we going to lock in and solidify this fortress and lock in these high fares? I'm concerned about what this will do. Will it have a chilling effect on some of Northwest's competitors? And you know, ATA, I think that's helpful, but they're still in bankruptcy. I wouldn't hang our hat necessarily on ATA providing us with low fare relief for the long term. So I'm interested in your thoughts about that.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Tigua.
Just by way of background, Northwest has 65% of the passengers but 80% of the operations, just as a distinction. But I also want to mention that 70% of the passengers who come through MSP have an alternative choice. But I think, as many of us know, a lot of us have frequent flyer miles and or frequent flyer cards in our wallet, and sometimes that influences our choices. 98% of the passengers that fly out of MSP have a nonstop or a one-stop choice to their destination. So it is not just about flying Northwest. Excuse me. Since 1998, 17 airlines have entered into new service at MSP. I won't bother to list them for you, and they're not all still around. But the one thing we don't do is we don't set airline pricing, and the consumers make those choices. And ultimately, we're going to have more people. We're going to have a greater demand here for people to fly out of MSP, and I think we need to have gates available to offer people more choices.
If I might just add, Mr. Chair, Representative Weinstein, Minneapolis-St. Paul has never denied access to any airline company that wanted to serve the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. NOCA has been denied access. Minneapolis-St. Paul remains one of the lowest cost, most competitive airports in the country. And as a result, it's not because of the pricing mechanisms or MAC policy or lack of facilities that they are not serving the community. It's because in the boardroom of major carriers, they made decisions and chosen not to serve the Minneapolis-St. Paul market or not expand the market. Specifically to your question concerning the attitude of the airlines being asked to consider moving over to the Humphrey Terminal building, I don't think it's any secret that United Airlines and AirTran Airways were the two airline companies that were most resistant. We've had very constructive and progressive talks with both airline companies, who quite frankly are looking at the entire opportunity at the Humphrey Terminal as being a significantly different situation than they first anticipated. Specifically, what they're looking at is making the move over and looking at helping us develop facilities so that, in fact, their needs can be met and growth opportunities can be provided at the same time.
Thank you.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, members. Ms. Tidwell, you mentioned that you just mentioned briefly that you won't speculate about what Northwest Airlines will do in the future. But if I understood your presentation correctly, part of the three-phase plan, the cost of $720 million, would be paid for with charges or fees that the airlines pay to MAC. And I'm not sure I have this all correct, but if I can recall correctly, United Airlines refused or was unable to pay their full amount of dues charged by the Denver Airport Commission or whatever it's called out there. And so my question is, what can the MAC do, or what's in place now to prevent that, or to make sure that Northwest is required to pay for that? And then the follow-up question is, what percent of the three-phase plan relies on airline fees or fees paid to the MAC?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a very complicated answer to your question about how rates and charges are structured at the airport, but let me first say that the air side of the airport is charged back to the airlines on a cost basis, so whatever it costs is what they pay. The terminal side to the airlines is charged on a completely different formula. We have fairly strong credit procedures, in place at the airport, and where airports get in trouble is when they have carriers who are, you know, 60, 90, and 120 days out, because those are the revenues that you lose in a bankruptcy. Going forward, if you need to use the facility, you need to keep, when you're in bankruptcy, you need to keep current with your payments. So in terms of what would be in jeopardy, I'm assuming you're thinking of it in case of a bankruptcy, it would be 30 days of whatever the payable is at that moment. And we have very, I think, well-enforced credit policies. We did get nicked up a little bit with United, but, you know, nothing that is terminally threatening to the airport.
We have to make this quick. We're running out of time here, but Representative Larson, can I bypass you for a minute? We need to get to Seibert, Representative Seibert, who hasn't been sitting there just looking at us, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Tidwell, you mentioned the total amount of dollars, economic value with the 2020 plan and total amount of jobs. Do you have a projection of additional jobs that will come into the area with the 2020 plan?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Actually, the numbers that I mentioned are the airport as it is currently configured. It doesn't contemplate the expansion. And I'm going to try and recall this from memory. I think the expansion in its total completion, which is all three phases, is about 42,000 jobs and I think an additional 5,000 construction jobs.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment that comes from Representative Anderson's question, and I just think it's important to sort of clarify the context in which we look at the noise mitigation program at MSP. If you look back to 1996 when the legislature made the decision about whether to stay or to move to a new site, one of the trade-offs was if we stay in its current site, the state and the Airports Commission saves considerable funds by not constructing an entirely new facility. One of the trade-offs in that discussion was, should we then make an effort to be even friendlier to the communities that will have the airport growing toward them? And it seemed somewhat clear to me from the folks that I've talked to as it related to the 96, and I wasn't in the legislature that year or yet, but was that that there was some level of desire to have a package that is somewhat pioneering, but it's a deal that's made with the communities that surround the current facility, that if we're going to grow toward you, we're also going to have a better noise mitigation package. And just so folks around the table know, what's being currently offered by the Metropolitan Airports Commission in terms of its package from the 60 to 64, I was briefed by Bloomington City officials just this week, and their estimate is that 95% or better of Bloomington residents that fit within that zone already have an air conditioner in their home, so they'd immediately be would not qualify for this. And so I don't know what it is for the rest of the communities, but I think people would generally agree in the communities that surround the airport that the package that's being referred to by Chair Tidwell is as close to nothing as is possible.
Quickly from Representative Beard, and that's about the last.
Okay, just a comment to the members about the overall my overall impressions of the 2020 plan and the job that's being done here is, I guess, cautiously optimistic. And you know how important I think the reliever airports are to the business community around the Twin Cities, but it's only fair to point out that MSP is not just important to this region, but it's important to the entire state and the upper Midwest, actually. Towns like Thief River Falls and International Falls, Hibbing, Duluth, Rochester, Fairmont, St. Cloud, those folks actually have access to the world through the commuter flights that come into this hub. Expanding this hub is critical, not just to the Twin Cities economy, but to the entire state members. And I ask that you just hold those thoughts as you go forward. A fully loaded 747 takes so many minutes in one gate to do its business at the airport. Well, a Saab 340 from International Falls with 12 people on it takes just as many minutes and a gate as the 747 does. So if we're going to have vital transportation with the smaller airplanes and the smaller passenger loads from outstate cities, greater Minnesota cities, pardon me, it's important that we have gate capacity because they need gates too. They need runway capacity just as much as everyone else does. So I got to tip my hats to the MAC or Northwest or whoever wrote this plan. I think it is forward-looking. I'm glad that we're here talking about this today because in this entire mix of things, we want to be sure we keep the balance and keep the policy that people have gone before us have kind of set in place. But please remember that this airport is important to the upper Midwest and this entire state. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that someone on your staff ought to send a phone call to Metropolitan Council because I think they're counting on using some of those parking spaces. At least that's what they explained to us the last time we were on the rail line. And thank you all very much for putting up with all our questions. We appreciate your presentations. Very nice. And members, please remember to take the popping water bottles with you at the end of the meeting, and the meeting is over.